Chapter 5. Ursa Minor Beta is, some say, one of the most appalling places in the known universe. Although it is excruciatingly rich, horrifyingly sunny, and more full of wonderfully exciting people than the pomegranate is of pips, it can hardly be insignificant that when a recent edition of Playbeing magazine headlined an article with the words, "When you are tired of Ursa Minor Beta, you are tired of life," the suicide rate there quadrupled overnight. Not that there are any nights on Ursa Minor Beta. It is a West Zone planet which, by an inexplicable and somewhat suspicious freak of topography, consists almost entirely of subtropical coastline. By an equally suspicious freak of temporal relastatics, it is nearly always Saturday afternoon, just before the beach bars close. No adequate explanation for this has been forthcoming from the dominant life forms of Ursa Minor Beta, who spend most of their time attempting to achieve spiritual enlightenment by running around swimming pools and inviting investigation officials from the Galactic Geotemporal Control Board to have a nice diurnal anomaly. There is only one city on Ursa Minor Beta, and that is only called a city because the swimming pools are slightly thicker on the ground there than elsewhere. If you approach Light City by air, and there is no other way of approaching it, no roads, no port facilities, if you don't fly, they don't want to see you in Light City. You will see why it has this name. Here the sun shines brightest of all, glittering on the swimming pools, shimmering on the white, palm-lined boulevards, glistening on the healthy, bronzed specks moving up and down them, gleaming off the villas, the hazy air pads, the beach bars, and so on. Most particularly, it shines on a building, a tall, beautiful building consisting of 2 30-story white towers connected by a bridge halfway up their length. The building is the home of a book, and was built here on the proceeds of an extraordinary copyright lawsuit fought between the book's editors and a breakfast cereal company. The book is a guidebook, a travel book. It is one of the most remarkable, certainly the most successful books, ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor, more popular than Life Begins at 550, better selling than The Big Bang Theory, A Personal View, by Eccentrica Galumbitz, the triple-breasted whore of Eroticon 6, and more controversial than Ulan Kalufid's latest blockbusting title, Everything You Never Wanted to Know About Sex But Have Been Forced to Find Out. And in many of the more relaxed civilizations on the outer eastern rim of the galaxy, it has long supplanted the great Encyclopedia Galactica as the standard repository of all knowledge and wisdom. Although it has many omissions and contains much that is apocryphal, or at least wildly inaccurate, it scores over the older, more pedestrian work in 2 important respects. First, it is slightly cheaper, and secondly, it has the words "Don't Panic" printed in large, friendly letters on its cover. It is, of course, that invaluable companion for all those who want to see the marvels of the known universe for less than 30 Altarian dollars a day, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. If you stood with your back to the main entrance lobby of the guide offices, assuming you had landed by now and freshened up with a quick dip and shower, then walked east, you would pass along the leafy shade of Life Boulevard, be amazed by the pale golden colour of the beaches stretching away to your left, astounded by the mind surfers floating carelessly along 2 feet above the waves, as if this was nothing special, surprised and eventually slightly irritated by the giant palm trees that hum tuneless nothings throughout the daylight hours, in other words, continuously. If you then walk to the end of Life Boulevard, you would enter the Lalamatine district of shops, bolonut trees, and pavement cafes, where the UM Beatons come to relax after a hard afternoon's relaxation on the beach. The Lalamatine district is one of those very few areas which don't enjoy a perpetual Saturday afternoon. It enjoys instead the cool of a perpetual early Saturday evening. Behind it lie the nightclubs. If on this particular day, afternoon, stretch of evening time, call it what you will, you had approached the second pavement cafe on the right, you would have seen the usual crowd of UM Beatons chatting, drinking, looking very relaxed, and casually glancing at each other's watches to see how expensive they were. You would also have seen a couple of rather dishevelled-looking hitchhikers from Algol, who had recently arrived on an Arcturan mega-freighter, aboard which they had been roughing it for a few days. They were angry and bewildered to discover that here, within sight of the Hitchhiker's Guide building itself, a simple glass of fruit juice cost the equivalent of over 60 Altarian dollars. "Sell out," one of them said bitterly. If at that moment you had then looked at the next table but one, you would have seen Zaphod Beeblebrox, sitting and looking very startled and confused. The reason for his confusion was that 5 seconds earlier he had been sitting on the bridge of the starship Heart of Gold. "Absolute sellout," said the voice again. Zaphod looked nervously out of the corners of his eyes at the 2 disheveled hitchhikers at the next table. Where the hell was he? How had he got there? Where was his ship? His hand felt the arm of the chair on which he was sitting, and then the table in front of him. They seemed solid enough. He sat very still. "How can they sit and write a guide for hitchhikers in a place like this?" continued the voice. "I mean, look at it, look at it!" Zaphod was looking at it. Nice place, he thought. But where? And why? He fished in his pocket for his 2 pairs of sunglasses. In the same pocket, he felt a hard, smooth, unidentified lump of very heavy metal. He pulled it out and looked at it. He blinked at it in surprise. Where had he got that? He returned it to his pocket and put on the sunglasses, annoyed to discover that the metal object had scratched one of the lenses. Nevertheless, he felt much more comfortable with them on. They were a double pair of Jujanta 200 superchromatic peril-sensitive sunglasses, which had been specially designed to help people develop a relaxed attitude to danger. At the first hint of trouble, they turn totally black, and thus prevent you from seeing anything that might alarm you. Apart from the scratch, the lenses were clear. He relaxed, but only a little bit. The angry hitchhiker continued to glare at his monstrously expensive fruit juice. "Worst thing that ever happened to the guide moving to Ursa Minor Beta," he grumbled. "They've all gone soft. You know, I've even heard that they've created a whole electronically synthesized universe in one of their offices so they can go and research stories during the day and still go to parties in the evening. Not that day and evening mean much in this place." Ursa Minor Beta, thought Zaphod. At least he knew where he was now. He assumed that this must be his great-grandfather's doing. But why? Much to his annoyance, a thought popped into his mind. It was very clear and very distinct, and he had now come to recognize these thoughts for what they were. His instinct was to resist them. They were the preordained promptings from the dark and locked-off parts of his mind. He sat still and ignored the thought furiously. It nagged at him. He ignored it. It nagged at him. He ignored it. It nagged at him. He gave in to it. Ah, what the hell, he thought. Go with the flow. He was too tired, confused, and hungry to resist. He didn't even know what the thought meant. Chapter 6. Megadodo Publications, home of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the most totally remarkable book in the whole known universe. "Can I help you?" said the large pink-winged insect into one of the 70 phones lined up along the vast chrome expanse of the reception desk in the foyer of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy offices. It fluttered its wings and rolled its eyes. It glared at all the grubby people cluttering up the foyer, soiling the carpets and leaving dirty handmarks on the upholstery. It adored working for the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It just wished that there was some way of keeping all the hitchhikers away. Weren't they meant to be hanging around dirty spaceports or something? It was certain that it had read something somewhere in the book about the importance of hanging around dirty spaceports. Unfortunately, most of them seemed to come and hang around in this nice, clean, shiny foyer immediately after hanging around in extremely dirty spaceports. And all they ever did was complain. It shivered its wings. "What?" it said into the phone. "Yes, I passed on your message to Mr. Zarniwoop, but I'm afraid he's too cool to see you right now. He's on an intergalactic cruise." It waved a petulant tentacle at one of the grubby people who was angrily trying to engage its attention. The petulant tentacle directed the angry person to look at the notice on the wall to its left, and not to interrupt an important phone call. "Yes," said the insect, "he is in his office, but he's on an intergalactic cruise. Thank you so much for calling." It slammed down the phone. "Read the notice," it said to the angry man who was trying to complain about one of the more ludicrous and dangerous pieces of misinformation contained in the book. "The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is an indispensable companion to all those who are keen to make sense of life in an infinitely complex and confusing universe. for though it cannot hope to be useful or informative on all matters, it does at least make the reassuring claim that where it is inaccurate, it is at least definitively inaccurate. In cases of major discrepancy, it's always reality that's got it wrong. This was the gist of the notice. It said, "The guide is definitive. Reality is frequently inaccurate." This has led to some interesting consequences. For instance, when the editors of the guide were sued by the families of those who had died as a result of taking the entry on the planet Tral literally, it said, "Ravenous bug bladder beasts often make a very good meal for visiting tourists," instead of "Ravenous bug bladder beasts often make a very good meal of visiting tourists," they claimed that the first version of the sentence was the more aesthetically pleasing, summoned a qualified poet to testify under oath that beauty was truth, truth beauty, and hoped thereby to prove that the guilty party in this case was life itself for failing to be either beautiful or true. The judges concurred, and in a moving speech held that life itself was in contempt of court, and duly confiscated it from all those there present, before going off to enjoy a pleasant evening's ultra-golf. Zaphod Beeblebrox entered the foyer. He strode up to the insect receptionist. "Okay," he said, "where's Zani Whoop? Get me Zani Whoop."
"Excuse me, sir," said the insect icily. It did not care to be addressed in this manner.
"Zani Whoop, get him, right? Get him now."
"Oh, well, sir," snapped the fragile little creature, "if you could be a little cool about it."
"Look," said Zaphod, "I'm up to here with cool, okay? I am so amazingly cool, you could keep a side of meat in me for a month. I'm so hip, I have difficulty seeing over my pelvis. Now will you move before I blow it?"
"Well, if you'd let me explain, sir," said the insect, tapping the most petulant of all the tentacles at its disposal, "I'm afraid that isn't possible right now, as Mr. Zani Whoop is on an intergalactic cruise."
"Hell," thought Zaphod. "When's he going to be back?" he said.
"Back, sir? He's in his office."
Zaphod paused whilst he tried to sort this particular thought out in his mind. He didn't succeed.
"This cat's on an intergalactic cruise in his office?"
He leaned forward and gripped the tapping tentacle.
"Listen, Three Eyes," he said, "don't you try to outweird me. I get stranger things than you free with my breakfast cereal."
"Well, just who do you think you are, honey?"
flounced the insect, quivering its wings in rage.
"Zaphod Beeblebrox or something?"
"Count the heads," said Zaphod in a low rasp.
The insect blinked at him. It blinked at him again.
"You are Zaphod Beeblebrox?"
it squeaked.
"Yeah," said Zaphod, "but don't shout it out or they'll all want one."
"The Zaphod Beeblebrox?"
"No, just a Zaphod Beeblebrox. Didn't you hear I come in six packs?"
The insect rattled its tentacles together in agitation.
"But, sir," it squealed, "I just heard on the Sarbetha radio report it said you were dead."
"Yeah, that's right," said Zaphod. "I just haven't stopped moving yet. Now, where do I find Zani Whoop?"
"Well, sir, he's in his office on the 15th floor, but..."
"But he's on an intergalactic cruise. Yeah, yeah, how do I get to him?"
"Well, the newly installed Sirius Cybernetics Corporation Happy Vertical People Transporters are in the far corner, sir, but, sir..."
Zaphod was turning to go. He turned back.
"Yeah?" he said.
"Can I ask you why you want to see Mr. Zani Whoop?"
"Yeah," said Zaphod, who was unclear on this point himself. "I told myself I had to."
"Come again, sir?"
Zaphod leaned forward conspiratorially.
"I just materialized out of thin air in one of your cafes," he said, "as a result of an argument with the ghost of my great-grandfather. No sooner had I got there than my former self, the one that operated on my brain, popped into my head and said, 'Go see Zani Whoop.' I've never heard of the cat, that's all I know. That and the fact that I've got to find the man who rules the universe." He winked.
"Mr. Beeblebrox, sir," said the insect in awed wonder, "you're so weird, you should be in movies."
"Yeah," said Zaphod, patting the thing on a glittering pink wing, "a new baby should be in real life."
The insect paused for a moment to recover from its agitation, and then reached out a tentacle to answer a ringing phone. A metal hand restrained it.
"Excuse me," said the owner of the metal hand in a voice that would have made an insect of a more sentimental disposition collapse in tears.
This was not such an insect, and it couldn't stand robots.
"Yes, sir," it snapped. "Can I help you?"
"I doubt it," said Marvin.
"Well, in that case, if you'll just excuse me..."
Six of the phones are now ringing. A million things awaited the insect's attention.
"No one can help me," intoned Marvin.
"Yes, sir, well..."
"Not that anyone's tried, of course." The restraining metal hand fell limply by Marvin's side. His head hung forward very slightly.
"Is that so?"
the insect said tartly.
"Hardly worth anyone's while to help a menial robot, is it?"
"I'm sorry, sir, if—"
"I mean, where's the percentage in being kind or helpful to a robot if it doesn't have any gratitude circuits?"
"And you don't have any?"
said the insect, who didn't seem to be able to drag itself out of this conversation.
"I've never had occasion to find out," Marvin informed it.
"Listen, you miserable heap of maladjusted metal."
"Aren't you going to ask me what I want?"
The insect paused. Its long, thin tongue darted out and licked its eyes and darted back again.
"Is it worth it?"
it asked.
"Is anything," said Marvin immediately.
"What do you want?"
"I'm looking for someone."
"Who?"
hissed the insect.
"Zaphod Beeblebrox," said Marvin. "He's over there."
The insect shook with rage. It could hardly speak.
"Then why did you ask me?" it screamed.
"I just wanted something to talk to," said Marvin.
"What?"
"Pathetic, isn't it?"
With a grinding of gears, Marvin turned and trundled off. He caught up with Zaphod approaching the elevators. Zaphod spun round in astonishment.
"Hey, Marvin," he said. "Marvin, how did you get here?"
Marvin was forced to say something which came very hard to him.
"I don't know," he said.
"But—"
"One moment I was sitting in your ship feeling very depressed, and the next moment I was standing here feeling utterly miserable. An improbability field, I expect."
"Yeah," said Zaphod. "I expect my great-grandfather sent you along to keep me company."
"Thanks a bundle, Grandad," he added to himself under his breath.
"So, how are you?" he said aloud.
"Oh, fine," said Marvin, "if you happen to like being me, which personally I don't."
"Yeah, yeah,"
said Zaphod, as the elevator doors opened.
"Hello," said the elevator sweetly. "I am to be your elevator for this trip to the floor of your choice. I have been designed by the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation to take you, the visitor to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, into these their offices. If you enjoy your ride, which will be swift and pleasurable, then you may care to experience some of the other elevators which have recently been installed in the offices of the Galactic Tax Department, Boobyloo Baby Foods, and the Sirian State Mental Hospital, where many ex-Sirius Cybernetics Corporation's executives will be delighted to welcome your visits, sympathy, and happy tales of the outside world."
"Yeah," said Zaphod, stepping into it. "What else do you do besides talk?"
"I go up," said the elevator, "or down."
"Good," said Zaphod. "We're going up."
"Or down,"
the elevator reminded him.
"Yeah, okay, up, please."
There was a moment of silence.
"Down's very nice,"
suggested the elevator hopefully.
"Oh, yeah?"
"A super."
"Good," said Zaphod. "Now will you take us up?"
"May I ask you,"
inquired the elevator in its sweetest, most reasonable voice,
"if you've considered all the possibilities that down might offer you?"
Zaphod knocked one of his heads against the inside wall. He didn't need this, he thought to himself. This, of all things, he had no need of. He hadn't asked to be here. If he was asked at this moment where he would like to be, he would probably have said he would like to be lying on the beach with at least 50 beautiful women and a small team of experts working out new ways they could be nice to him, which was his usual reply. To this he would probably have added something passionate on the subject of food. One thing he didn't want to be doing was chasing after the man who ruled the universe, who was only doing a job which he might as well keep at, because if it wasn't him, it would only be someone else. Most of all, he didn't want to be standing in an office block, arguing with an elevator.
"Like what other possibilities?" he said wearily.
"Well,"
the voice trickled on like honey on biscuits,
"there's the basement, the microfiles, the heating system,
It paused.
"Nothing particularly exciting,"
it admitted,
"but they are alternatives."
"Holy Zarquan," muttered Zaphod. "Did I ask for an existential elevator?"
He beat his fists against the wall.
"What's the matter with this thing?" he spat.
"It doesn't want to go up," said Marvin simply. "I think it's afraid."
"Afraid?" cried Zaphod. "Of what heights? An elevator that's afraid of heights?"
"No,"
said the elevator miserably.
"Of the future."
"The future?" exclaimed Zaphod. "What does the wretched thing want? A pension scheme?"
At that moment, a commotion broke out in the reception hall behind them.
From the walls around them came the sound of suddenly active machinery.
"We can all see into the future," whispered the elevator in what sounded like terror. "It's part of our programming."
Seyfried looked out of the elevator. An agitated crowd had gathered round the elevator area, pointing and shouting. Every elevator in the building was coming down very fast. He ducked back in.
"Marvin," he said, "just get this elevator to go up, will you? We've got to get the Zani whoop."
"Why?" asked Marvin dolefully.
"I don't know," said Seyfried, "but when I found him, he'd better have a very good reason for me wanting to see him."
Modern elevators are strange and complex entities. The ancient electric winch and maximum capacity 8-persons jobs bear as much relation to a Sirius Cybernetics Corporation happy vertical people transporter as a packet of mixed nuts does to the entire west wing of the Syrian State Mental Hospital. This is because they operate on the curious principle of defocused temporal perception. In other words, they have the capacity to see dimly into the immediate future, which enables the elevator to be on the right floor to pick you up even before you knew you wanted it, thus eliminating all the tedious chatting, relaxing, and making friends that people were previously forced to do whilst waiting for elevators. Not unnaturally, many elevators, imbued with intelligence and precognition, became terribly frustrated with the mindless business of going up and down, experimented briefly with the notion of going sideways as a sort of existential protest, demanded participation in the decision-making process, and finally took to squatting in basements, sulking. An impoverished hitchhiker visiting any planets in the Sirius star system these days can pick up easy money working as a counsellor for neurotic elevators. At the 15th floor, the elevator doors snapped open quickly.
15th, said the elevator, "and remember, I'm only doing this because I like your robot."
Seyfried and Marvin bundled out of the elevator, which instantly snapped its doors shut and dropped as fast as its mechanism would take it. Seyfried looked around warily. The corridor was deserted and silent, and gave no clue as to where Zani Whoop might be found. All the doors that let off the corridor were closed and unmarked. They were standing close to the bridge which led across from one tower of the building to the other. Through a large window, the brilliant sun of Ursa Minor Beta threw blocks of light in which danced small specks of dust. A shadow flitted past momentarily.
"Left in the lurch by a lift," muttered Seyfried, who was feeling at his least jaunty.
They both stood and looked in both directions.
"You know something?" said Seyfried to Marvin.
"More than you can possibly imagine."
"I'm dead certain this building shouldn't be shaking," Seyfried said.
It was just a light tremor through the soles of his feet, and another one. In the sunbeams, the flecks of dust danced more vigorously. Another shadow flitted past. Seyfried looked at the floor.
"Either," he said, not very confidently, "they've got some new vibro system for toning up your muscles while you work, or..."
He walked across to the window, and suddenly stumbled, because at that moment his Jujanta 200 superchromatic peril-sensitive sunglasses had turned utterly black. A large shadow flitted past the window with a sharp buzz. Seyfried ripped off his sunglasses, and as he did so, the building shook with a thunderous roar.
He leapt to the window. "Oh," he said, "this building's being bombed!"
Another roar cracked through the building.
"Who in the galaxy would want to bomb a publishing company?" asked Seyfried,
but never heard Marvin's reply, because at that moment the building shook with another bomb attack. He tried to stagger back to the elevator, a pointless manoeuvre, he realised, but the only one he could think of. Suddenly, at the end of the corridor, leading at right angles from this one, he caught sight of a figure as it lunged into view. A man. The man saw him.
"Beeblebrox, over here!" he shouted.
Seyfried eyed him with distrust as another bomb blast rocked the building.
"No," called Seyfried. "Beeblebrox over here. Who are you?"
"A friend,"
shouted back the man. He ran towards Seyfried.
"Oh, yeah?" said Seyfried. "Anyone's friend in particular, or just generally well-disposed to people?"
The man raced along the corridor, the floor bucking beneath his feet like an excited blanket. He was short, stocky, and weather-beaten, and his clothes looked as if they'd been twice round the galaxy and back, with him in them.
"Do you know?" shouted Seyfried in his ear when he arrived. "Your building's being bombed!"
The man indicated his awareness. It suddenly stopped being light. Glancing round at the window to see why, Seyfried gaped as a huge, slug-like, gunmetal-grey spacecraft crept through the air past the building. Two more followed it.
The government you deserted is out to get you, Zaphod, hissed the man. They've sent a squadron of Frogstar fighters.
Frogstar fighters, muttered Zaphod.
Zarquan, you get the picture?
What are Frogstar fighters?
Zaphod was sure he'd heard someone talk about them when he was president, but he never paid much attention to official matters. The man was pulling him back through a door. He went with him. With a searing whine, a small black spider-like object shot through the air and disappeared down the corridor.
What was that? Hissed Zaphod. Frogstar Scout Robot Class A out looking for you, said the man. Hey, yeah? Get down!
From the opposite direction came a larger, black, spider-like object. It zapped past them.
And that was? A Frogstar Scout Robot Class B out looking for you. And that?
Said Zaphod as a third one seared through the air.
A Frogstar Scout Robot Class C out looking for you.
Hey,
chuckled Zaphod to himself. Pretty stupid robots, eh? From over the bridge came a massive rumbling hum. A gigantic black shape was moving over it from the opposite tower, the size and shape of a tank.
Holy photon, what's that?
Breathed Zaphod.
A tank, said the man. Frogstar Scout Robot Class D come to get you.
Should we leave?
I think we should. Marvin, called Zaphod.
What do you want?
Marvin rose from a pile of rubble further down the corridor and looked at them.
You see that robot coming towards us?
Marvin looked at the gigantic black shape edging forward towards them over the bridge. He looked down at his own small metal body. He looked back up at the tank.
I suppose you want me to stop it, he said.
Yeah.
Whilst you save your skins.
Yeah, said Zaphod. Get in there!
Just so long, said Marvin, as I know where I stand.
The man tugged at Zaphod's arm, and Zaphod followed him off down the corridor. A point occurred to him about this.
Where are we going? He said. Zani Whoop's office.
Is this any time to keep an appointment?
Come on.
Chapter 7 Marvin stood at the end of the bridge corridor. He was not, in fact, a particularly small robot. His silver body gleamed in the dusty sunbeams and shook with the continual barrage which the building was still undergoing. He did, however, look pitifully small as the gigantic black tank rolled to a halt in front of him. The tank examined him with a probe. The probe withdrew. Marvin stood there.
Out of my way, little robot!
Growled the tank.
I am afraid, said Marvin, that I've been left here to stop you.
The probe extended again for a quick recheck. It withdrew again.
You? Stop me?
Roared the tank.
Go on!
No, really, I have,
said Marvin simply.
What are you armed with?
Roared the tank in disbelief.
Yes,
said Marvin. The tank's engines rumbled, its gears ground. Molecule-sized electronic relays deep in its microbrain flipped backwards and forwards in consternation.
Guess!
Said the tank. Zaphod and the as-yet-unnamed man lurched up one corridor, down a second, and along a third. The building continued to rock and judder, and this puzzled Zaphod. If they wanted to blow the building up, why was it taking so long? With difficulty, they reached one of a number of totally anonymous, unmarked doors and heaved at it. With a sudden jolt, it opened and they fell inside. All this way, thought Zaphod, all this trouble, all this not lying on the beach having a wonderful time, and for what? A single chair, a single desk, and a single dirty ashtray in an undecorated office. The desk, apart from a bit of dancing dust and a single revolutionary new form of paperclip, was empty.
Where, said Zaphod, is Zani Whoop?
Feeling that his already tenuous grasp of the point of this whole exercise was beginning to slip.
He's on an intergalactic cruise, said the man.
Zaphod tried to size the man up. Earnest type, he thought, not a barrel of laughs. He probably apportioned a fair whack of his time to running up and down, heaving corridors, breaking down doors, and making cryptic remarks in empty offices.
Let me introduce myself, the man said. My name is Rooster, and this is my towel.
Hello, Rooster, said Zaphod. Hello, towel? He added as Rooster held out to him a rather nasty, old flowery towel. Not knowing what to do with it, he shook it by the corner. Outside the window, one of the huge slug-like, gunmetal green spaceships growled past.
Yes, go on,
said Marvin to the huge battle machine.
You'll never guess.
Said the machine, vibrating with unaccustomed thought.
Laser beams?
Marvin shook his head solemnly.
No,
muttered the machine in its deep guttural rumble.
Too obvious. Antimatter ray?
It hazarded.
Far too obvious,
admonished Marvin.
Yes,
grumbled the machine, somewhat abashed.
How about an electron ram?
This was new to Marvin.
What's that?
He said.
One of these,
said the machine with enthusiasm. From its turret emerged a sharp prong, which spat a single lethal blaze of light. Behind Marvin, a wall roared and collapsed as a heap of dust. The dust billowed briefly, then settled.
No, said Marvin, not one of those.
Good, though, isn't it?
Very good,
agreed Marvin.
I know,
said the Frogstar battle machine after another moment's consideration.
You must have one of those new Xanthic Restructron destabilized xenon emitters.
Nice, aren't they?
Said Marvin.
That's what you've got?
Said the machine in considerable awe.
No,
said Marvin.
Oh,
said the machine, disappointed.
Then it must be...
You're thinking along the wrong lines,
said Marvin.
You're failing to take into account something fairly basic in the relationship between men and robots.
Well, I know,
said the battle machine.
Is it?
It tailed off into thought again.
Just think,
urged Marvin.
They left me, an ordinary menial robot, to stop you, a gigantic heavy-duty battle machine, whilst they ran off to save themselves. What do you think they would leave me with?
Muttered the machine in alarm.
Something pretty damn devastating, I should expect.
Expect, said Marvin. Oh, yes, expect. I'll tell you what they gave me to protect myself with, shall I?
Yes, all right,
said the battle machine, bracing itself.
Nothing,
said Marvin. There was a dangerous pause.
Nothing,
roared the battle machine.
Nothing at all,
intoned Marvin dismally.
Not an electronic sausage.
The machine heaved about with fury.
Well, doesn't that just take a biscuit? It roared. Nothing, eh? Just don't think, do they?
And me, said Marvin in a soft, low voice, with this terrible pain in all the diodes down my left side.
Makes you spit, doesn't it?
Yes,
agreed Marvin with feeling.
Hell, that makes me angry,
bellowed the machine.
I think I'll smash that wall down.
The electron ram stabbed out another searing blaze of light and took out the wall next to the machine.
How do you think I feel?
Said Marvin bitterly.
Just ran off and left you, did they?
The machine thundered.
Yes,
said Marvin.
Think I'll shoot down a bloody ceiling as well,
raged the tank. It took out the ceiling of the bridge.
That's very impressive, murmured Marvin.
You ain't seen nothing yet,
promised the machine.
I can take out this floor too, no trouble.
It took out the floor too.
Hell's bells!
The machine roared as it plummeted 15 stories and smashed itself to bits on the ground below.
What a depressingly stupid machine,
said Marvin, and trudged away. Chapter 8. So, do we just sit here or what? Said Zaphod angrily. What do these guys out here want?
You, Beeble Brooks, said Rooster. They're going to take you to the Frogstar, the most totally evil world in the galaxy.
Oh, yeah? Said Zaphod. Well, they'll have to come and get me first.
They have come and got you, said Rooster. Look out of the window.
Zaphod looked and gaped.
The ground's going away, he gasped. Where are they taking the ground?
They're taking the building, said Rooster. We're airborne. Clouds streaked past the office window. Out in the open air again, Zaphod could see the ring of dark green Frogstar fighters round the uprooted tower of the building. A network of force beams radiated in from them and held the tower in a firm grip. Zaphod shook his head in perplexity.
What have I done to deserve this? He said. I walk into a building, they take it away.
It's not what you've done they're worried about, said Rooster. It's what you're going to do.
Well, don't I get a say in that?
You did, years ago. You'd better hold on, we're in for a fast and bumpy journey.
If I ever meet myself, said Zaphod, I'll hit myself so hard I won't know what's hit me.
Marvin trudged in through the door,
looked at Zaphod accusingly, slumped in a corner, and switched himself off. On the bridge of the Heart of Gold, all was silent. Arthur stared at the rack in front of him and thought. He caught Trillian's eyes as she looked at him inquiringly. He looked back at the rack. Finally, he saw it. He picked up 5 small plastic squares and laid them on the board that lay just in front of the rack. The 5 squares had on them the 5 letters E, X, Q, U, and I. He laid them next to the letters S, I, T, E. Exquisite, he said, on a triple word score. Scores rather a lot, I'm afraid. The ship bumped and scattered some of the letters for the nth time. Trillian sighed and started to sort them out again. Up and down the silent corridors echoed Ford Prefect's feet as he stalked the ship, thumping dead instruments. Why did the ship keep shaking, he thought. Why did it rock and sway? Why could he not find out where they were? Where, basically, were they?